Welcome to Audio Gyan with Kedar Nimkar, a podcast that documents insightful conversations with Indian designers, artists, musicians, writers, thinkers, and creatives of all types. Here's your host, Kedar Nimkar.
Today, I have a writer, traveler, and photographer, Shivaji Das, with us on Audio Gyan. He has authored few books like Off the Beaten Track, Collecting Stories of Unheard Lives, Journeys with the Caterpillar, Traveling Through the Islands of Flores and Sumba, Indonesia, and most recently, The Other Shangri-La. Shivaji's writing and work with migrants have been published in journals such as Time, The Economist, BBC, and more. He was born and brought up in the northeastern province of Assam and now stays in Singapore. Today, we are here to discuss about travel writing. Is it a practice or can it be a profession, and more about his book and the travel journey experiences. So let's find out. Thanks, Shivaji, for giving your time, and it's a real pleasure to have you on Audio again.
Thanks, Kedar. Happy to be here.
So I'm just going to have a small joke here that this is like one conversation where I'm going to address Shivaji as Shivaji and not really the Shivaji Maharaj, the Chhatrapati Shivaji Maharaj, which is So it's going to be slightly different for me as well.
No worries, no pressure on you.
Yeah. So the entire premise which I wanted to cover was about travel writing and writing being an art form. Are there any specifics about travel and also more about travel as an art form? So how do you document? How do you cover these stories? How do you curate within the experiences which you had while traveling and things like that? So to begin with, I would start by asking, what is different about travel writing? I mean, the way in general writing, you have these articles or opinions or factual documentation. Even in journalism, you have these sort of different forms, right? So are there any subsections in travel writing? We can start there and then open up more questions as we go along.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, there are different subsections within travel writing. And because of the advent of the internet and new media, there have been many more appendages or new subsections attached to this whole idea of travel writing. Now, one of the things which makes travel writing slightly different from other forms of writing or nonfiction in general is that it involves traveling in the first place. So many other writing, even nonfiction, you could probably just do sitting in your armchair. But travel writing is where traveling comes perhaps first, and the way you travel, where you go, how you travel, what you see, what you hear, it influences and matters a lot the writing that you produce. Of course, like any other form of writing, who you are also influences a lot the genre of travel writing. So, in the till I think the 1940s, till the Second World War, travel writing was perhaps the most important or most looked forward to genre of writing. And since then, things have changed. But till the 1940s, travel writing had a lot of intersection with anthropological writing, historical writing, economics, sociology, and so on. And travelers were looked upon to provide information on all these dimensions to anywhere they went to. But since 1945, since the Second World War was over, I would say that many of these fields like anthropology, sociology got highly specialized, and travel writers lost that respect which they used to get. As of today, the big difference is, first of all, that you need to travel before you can actually write. In nonfiction, for instance, if you're doing business writing, you could probably just do some research, sitting where you are interviewing people. Now, I would also say that many critics have argued that travel writing is not pure nonfiction. I mean, often travel writing is put in the broader umbrella of nonfiction, but many critics have also said that unlike in nonfiction, where you have to stick to the facts 100% of the time, in travel writing, you make many conscious decisions to omit several aspects. For example, let's say you took a bus, which seat you sat in, which what places went by as you look through your window. All these could be omitted by the travel writer if it doesn't really add. So in that sense, you are not sticking 100% to the facts as it happens. So there are some arguments that it's not pure nonfiction and it sits somewhere between fiction and nonfiction. But having said that, even today, there's a lot of intersection between travel writing, journalism, memoir writing. What we see that some new subsections have evolved. For instance, there are very niche travel writing in the sense that there is a book by Adam Minter talking about Junkyard Planet, in which he follows the journey of garbage or trash as it goes from one country to another, and his travel writing is centered around that. So that can be very such niche elements. There's another subsection of travel writing which is about retracing. So you retrace some famous journeys which may have happened in the past. For instance, you know, Yuan Shang came all the way to India from China. So there could be another travel writer who tries to replicate the same journey. There are also coming of age, like transformational kind of travel writing in which, say, a teenager goes to Canada. There's this writer called Siprapatram, a Canadian writer. She has been traveling around the world while she was reaching her puberty. So it's kind of you age as and when you travel. So coming of age, life transformation kind of stories. They're also like pilgrimage-based travel writing, spiritual travel writing, which is there. But I would also say that there are some fiction-based travel writing as well, in which you loosely create characters and plot lines centered around actual travel. So books like that have also come in. And with the advent of internet and new media, there are many new subsections which have been added. So whether it's blogs, whether it's journals, whether it's YouTube channels, whether it's Instagram, all these could also be considered some form of travel content or travel writing, all the way to a TripAdvisor review. So in a sense, in a summary, yeah, travel writing is somewhat different from other forms because here traveling is very much the core, and how you travel is very much the core part of the whole experience and the output. And then there are these new sections which have evolved, especially after the advent of internet.
Fascinating. Fascinating to know so many subsections within it. And so you mentioned about spiritual travel as well, and I'm particularly interested in that aspect as well. But I've heard this phrase called as ego travel. But from my understanding, which I've been trying to do, is that when you say like you go and settle down in, or you just go and travel in some part of interior India or Nepal or any city, and you just from that moment, the moment you land there, you just think that you're born and brought up here. So you don't really compare the stuff with where you used to stay, which typically happens when people travel, right? So I can give you a very like silly example, but it's a very profound one, that a lot of people are obsessed with the Mumbai Pani Puri, and if they go to Calcutta or some other place, they just think that this is not happening, while those people might think that in the Mumbai one might not be happening, right? So this is where I sort of, I don't know whether it's a real word also, ego travel, but it's something, you got the drift, right, where what I'm talking about. You can share what does it mean to you, and also in one of your articles you mentioned that you know when to be honest about the various fears and phobias you're attempting to overcome when you're in a foreign territory or maybe like a dangerous area or something like that. So any examples to explain this, and what is your definition or understanding about ego travel in general?
Sure. I think the way I would understand ego travel is more about using travel as a way to show off. Yeah, I think that's how many, especially in the Western markets, they would consider ego travel as. So, you know, the whole purpose of traveling is kind of to be able to post Instagram photos or YouTube videos and all that, social media posts and so on. So that is kind of my understanding. It's kind of giving you an ego boost and as a show off that you have been there, done that, you have completed the bucket lists and so on. And with that definition, I mean, nothing wrong with that. I mean, all said and done, and many things that we do is centered around that, whether you buy a motorcycle or whether you watch a movie, there's some element of ego attached with many activities that we do. And one of the benefits of travel, which if even if it's done in a very haphazard or very siloed way, is that it will expose you in very insignificant amount, even if that happens, to different culture, to different people, to different ways of living. And that creates some level of openness, and if not openness, some level of questioning of your biases. And you know, even if it's eco travel, if that small impact happens, I don't see anything wrong with that. Did I get that part right? Yeah.
No, actually, I was talking about the other part. In fact, this is also quite an interesting perspective. I was taking more on the lines of you killing your ego, because when you're traveling, you're actually stepping out of your bubble, stepping out of your comfort zone. And then that you're such a tiny like drop of water in the ocean kind of a thing. And that's where you kill your ego while traveling. And I wanted to understand that aspect more.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that happens, but rarely happens. You know, I've met and heard so many travelers. They're often complaining that things are not working out. The air conditioning is not working. The hotel has bed bugs. So there's a lot of complaining that you hear from other fellow travelers, because especially when they're traveling to less developed countries than what they're used to living in, that they find it very hard, that many of the comforts and many of the privileges that they're used to may not be extended to them when that happens. But yeah, there is a small segment of people who do that. They try to, I would say it happens rather than it's something that they can force upon themselves. In many cases, it happens by itself. Like you find sometimes in a natural setting, you find that you are, say, tenting in an open area and with millions and billions of stars. You know, you get that sense of being very small and insignificant. Similarly, if you are in a crowded street of Calcutta or in Churchgate Station, for instance, you see these millions of people and you get that sense of being very small and insignificant. So I think in that sense, the more you do immersive travel, that feeling sometimes does come in, that you know you are a small part of it. But at the same time, at least in my case and many other travelers' case, there are aspects of your personality and aspects of your culture deep inside yourself, which is very hard to leave behind, no matter how hard you try.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people also like Guerra who have like changed their entire life because of travel. So it can be very important. Yeah. Cool.
Transformation.
Yeah.
Now, you asked about the biases and the phobias. If I just quickly mention one or two things about that. I mean, first and foremost, the biases and the fears and phobias relate to the whole unfamiliarity of the place itself. You know, like language could be unfamiliar, the whole way they do things. Just give a simple example: the way they ask the public transport to stop when they need to get down. You know, some of these things are different, and that causes a lot of hesitations and uncomfortable feelings. Now, there are also many stereotypes that, no matter how open you think you are, come into your mind, that you kind of think that, okay, all Chinese people are going to be like this, or all Western people are going to be like this. So those leads to certain biases and phobias as well. And for me, as a travel writer, not necessarily as a traveler, but both as a travel writer and a traveler, the two things that I need to overcome is number one, my shyness. And what I've seen that I've written a lot about this thing, and I've in my workshops, I've talked a lot about this thing, that many interesting things happen in front of your eyes when they're traveling. You meet many interesting characters, but you are often shy to engage with them. But all it takes is to say a hello, And then an entire floodgate of very interesting story of that person's life comes to you. And this person will share everything about his life or her life to you, just if you say that, hi. So I understand it, but I would say 90% of that time when I travel, I'm too shy to ask about it. And if I'm not shy and I say that hello and make that first move, the kind of material I get, the kind of richness I get from that travel is what leads to many of the stories I write about.
This also connects to the thing which you mentioned in the beginning, that who you travel with. So if you're traveling solo, are there chances of this happening more as opposed to, because you travel with your wife and so any observations you had there?
There are two aspects to this. I must say that there are certain cases when the chances of spontaneous interactions, deep interactions are more when you are traveling solo, because you have that complete freedom of choice. You are not worried about the other person, what is his or her thoughts about this next possible move that you are going to make. So you are kind of the king of your own hill. And I have traveled alone quite a fair bit, and I have taken a bit more risk in some of these cases than I would have perhaps if I was traveling with my wife. But having said that, I must also say that traveling with a companion, and especially in my case, I am married to a person from a different race, different country, different language. And since it's a woman, sometimes I get this opportunity to interact a lot more with women when I'm traveling. And maybe if I was traveling solo, many of these women who we meet, who could be a simple villager, farmer, artisan, they would probably not have opened up as much to me if I was traveling solo. But I get that benefit if I'm traveling with my wife. They are more trusting, or they are more open to the other person. And also I get this benefit of language. Between the two of us, we try to learn different languages. So there are some places where she has better grasp of the language. So we kind of team up to make more out of the places we go to. So I would say this, yes and no. If you have the right company, sometimes you may be able to make more out of your travels. Mm-hmm.
So how many languages do you speak? I mean, put together, both of you?
Okay, so, you know, there are many Indian languages that I speak, having grown up in India. So I would say about 5 Indian languages I can reasonably manage well. And then there's another 5 where I can find vegetarian food and I can find directions to certain places. So I would say about 10 in total for me, and maybe about 3 for my wife. So about 13 languages we can hang around with other people.
Segue to another question, which I wanted to ask you, is that, do you write about people or do you write about places? And then how, or what is your definition about a place also? Because when you're writing, it's continuously, the lines are very blur, right? You can't really specifically talk about place or a person or a particular incident, but it encapsulates a lot more things. So is it the people, or is it the geographical location, or is it the culture even? So what is found within? So if you can tell us, maybe by taking example of the other Shangri-La or any other experience that you have, and help us understand that, what is the overall process of writing also?
Right. Thanks for asking that. In my opinion, when I talk about a place, I would think of everything together. I would think of the geography. I would think of the people living there, the culture, the history, the economics, very importantly, the economic and the material aspect of their lives, all those together I would consider as a place. Yeah. And from a traveling experience per se, again, I'm going back to traveling because travel writing has this close relationship with how you travel and, in the writing part itself. So what I have witnessed is that even if you go to the most stunning or most drastic, dramatic location, you know, whether it's a volcanic pit or whether it's a very high mountain, it does appear quite striking when you are there, and you might enjoy it thoroughly or be scared by it thoroughly, but that experience kind of fades away very fast. But in my case, it is the interactions with the people which have tended to linger on for much longer. And today, if I look back, some of the travels I did 10 years back, what I remember most are the people, the characters I met, the stories I encountered, not so much the visuals of that place or the geographic aspects of that place. But as I was saying, all these are closely interrelated. I'll just give you an example that we have traveled a fair bit among the Caucasus countries, the Caucasus mountain countries like Georgia, Abkhazia, Azerbaijan, Armenia. And similarly, in the other Shangri-La, we have traveled along the Tibetan plateau. And what happens is that many of these mountainous locations, you have these valleys in between these high mountain peaks. And over time, this geography has led to isolated settlements in some sense. Yeah. So isolated, I mean, there were still interactions between the different settlements, but there was some variation in culture, language, religion in some cases, which happened in these small pockets, just because of the geographical nature of valleys located between mountains. And that has led to a lot of conflicts. I mean, that one village will attack another village, some subcultures will come around in different valleys and they will think badly of the other subculture. And that has led to this, over the last 1,000, 2,000 years, these very different aspects of life and ways of thinking among these different settlements. So when we went around in Caucasus countries, we found that, you know, even like a place which as the crow flew could be only 10 kilometers away, but they had very different lifestyle, different language, different religion, and very different understanding of the other person who was just living 10 kilometers away. And marriages were impossible between these two groups of people. They would always be suspicious of each other. And all this leads to, of course, bad or sorrowful stories, but also very fascinating stories. And in a way, when I talk about place, as you mentioned, the interplay of all these things has led to where they are today and has led to these people that we come across when we're traveling through these parts.
So Shivaji, I wanted to ask you, since you mentioned about like you writing about people the most and at times the geographies as well. And there's also one more thing which you mentioned about whom you're traveling with. So I had gone to Pondicherry with my friend and if we both were supposed to write our experience of just one morning, it was quite different because the shop where we went to have breakfast, the person there was actually going out and getting some vegetables and bread. So like making a sandwich was almost like a hour long process. And we were from Bombay, so it felt completely different. I was very happy because he got me into the kitchen. I was helping him cut the vegetables and it was a completely positive experience for me. Right. So any insights there which you can share, that if you have to get into travel writing, or is there anything which is like a good travel writer is more empathetic towards the situation and thereby sharing the observations in a different perspectives? You know what I mean, right?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I mean, within travel writing, there's a more serious form of travel writing, which nowadays literary agents or publishers will ask you to rather classify as creative nonfiction rather than calling travel writing. In which case, you know, such kind of deep introspection or empathy is quite highly valued. But, you know, travel writing in general, it also includes things like what you read in the magazines, in the airline brochures and all these things where you are just describing, or guidebooks, for instance, where you don't necessarily need to have a very good connection with the people that you are meeting with. But when it comes to the more serious literary forms of travel writing, the ones you mentioned, for instance, well-known travel writers such as Jan Morris, who recently died, I think yesterday, and then Colin Tobron, Paul Theroux, and so on. They always try to build that connection and talk about these characters that you meet. So in a sense, the essentials of good travel writing is not very different from other writing in that sense that you need to have very powerful characters that you come across, which show themselves and express themselves in the pages. You need to have great dialogues, which come in from these people. You need to have the kind of sense of structure, pacing, organizing the whole work, which is very relevant in other forms of writing as well. So yes, in terms of the experience part, the traveling part, the more you are willing to listen, the more you are able to hear. And that's where language also plays a big part, because if you can understand the person in their languages, it opens a lot more avenues for interaction other than just talking to people from the travel industry. And once you've done that traveling part, you need to augment that with very thorough research, especially research about the material aspects of life there, history, geography, and so on, intercultural relationships there. And then comes the writing aspect per se, which involves things like structure, dialogue, sentence length, paragraphing, and so on, which any other good writing would also entail.
Mm-hmm. So I have two questions there. One is, you mentioned about doing research after the travel as well. It is because these anecdotes are very powerful, but they are, someone has said, nah, anecdotes are not data. So but still anecdotes are so powerful that you tend to believe in them more naturally than like really counter-checking. So how do you deal with that? And second is when you are actually we'll just first discuss this part and then I'll come back to the next question.
Sure. So over the last few years, as I've written more and more, I've become less ambitious with my travel writing. So when I visit a place, let's say I visit Indonesia or I visit Japan, I don't make that claim anymore that my book is about Japan or my book is about Indonesia. I think it's almost impossible to be so courageous to make such a claim that I've been able to experience and capture the whole of Japan or even the whole of Tokyo or even just one neighborhood there, say Minato-ku, because you can only meet as many people there, you can only understand as much nuances of life even in a small neighborhood. So what I tried to talk about in, or the way I tried to describe my travel writing, is that it's a combination of interactions with some interesting people that I've met along my journey who are perhaps different from our day-to-day life, and then try to set a context of why they are behaving in a certain way or talking in a certain way or interacting with me in a certain way. And to explain that context is where I need to do that research into the history, the economics, the culture of that place, so that the reader and myself as well can get a better or nuanced understanding of why this character is interacting the way he or she is. Yeah. So I would say that, you know, I've become less ambitious. I try to position my travel writing as more of these snippets of interactions with fascinating characters who are different from us, and then set them in a context of a wider geopolitical, historical, geographical narrative.
Mm-hmm. And do you set out, or do you or any of the travel writers whom you look up to, or your contemporaries as well, do they set out with a idea, or is it the data which gives them hints of how to navigate the story? I mean, in documentary filmmaking, you don't really start off with a plot, right? You do your research and then right, something emerges out of it. So same happens with this as well?
I would say there's a mix of that. In my own writing also, I have done a mix of that. So for instance, I was doing a piece on the women boxers of Philippines. And Philippines, if you know, they are very well known for their men boxers, like Manny Pacquiao has been a world champion for so many years. But they have these excellent women boxers as well. And they come from very humble conditions. They grew up in very poor environments. So I did a story on that, and I was very focused, like, this is what I need to do. These are the people I need to interview, and everything had been planned. So that was a kind of story writing where, or travel writing, where it was very focused and I knew what I had to do. And I did that and I wrote about that. But in my longer pieces, and which I believe many of the other travel writers would also be doing, if they were to write more longer book format kind of pieces, there would be certain milestones which will sort of serve as lighthouses along that journey. For instance, when I went to the Tibetan Highlands in Sichuan, the other Shangri-La is the book that came out of it, I had these five or six things that I knew I would like to cover, like the largest monastery and the highest slum in the world called Ladong, the oldest queendom that existed in this place called Danba, which still is famous for its courageous and beautiful women. So I knew that there'll be these five or six milestones and lighthouses that will guide me along the journey. But then I leave sufficient amount of accidental or serendipitous encounters. So, and that leads to maybe half or sometimes even more of the story or experience that comes out of that travel. So I would say writers try to do both things. There are some who are very focused and they follow that scripted journey. And there are some who follow those milestones and then leave enough ability to take these random or spontaneous interactions with the people.
Sorry to just go deeper, then how do you pick these areas? Because the when you said women boxers in Philippines is quite not a natural thing to think about, right?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's a random brainwave that comes in. I don't know how the brain works, and suddenly you get this idea that okay, I should follow the women boxers. And sometimes you just hear from other people, and then you do some research and see, okay, no one has written much about it, and then you go to that place. So one of the pieces that I did was, for instance, these diamond miners in a part of Indonesia, and they are still doing artisanal mining. That you know, they flood a pit and then they dig by hand and they seed by hand and they get small pieces. Yeah, incidentally, they found one of the biggest diamonds in the world in 1960. So these are some things that you hear say as you travel around certain places, and then you do some research and see, okay, no one has really talked about it much in the world, and then you try to go deeper. So there's something which you know, just comes in, and something which you just find out through your research or find out through talking to other people, and then you see that, okay, this is a story I believe the world should know, and I should do I should play a little part in bringing this out. And that's how it seems.
Cool. Moving on to the second last question, which is my personal favorite also, and my friend like asked me to, because he's quite traveled Maharashtra forts quite extensively in his teenage, and we are like a bunch of school friends who regularly travel twice a year, one like a big trek and then like one small trek nearby. So we have been to Neelkanth Pass and Roopkund and places like that, sometimes like somewhere in Uttarakhand itself. But like with advancement in modes of travel, now it has made easier for people to travel even in unreachable places. And since you have traveled so extensively, you must have gained some insight as to what have we gained with this advancement or possibilities to reach such virgin places, and what have we lost also. So if like both yin and yang of the technology part.
I think in general, I'm pretty positive about this. And I think we have gained a lot more with these cheaper modes of transport and better modes of transport and so on. And a classic example would be the this place in Sichuan that we went to, and that is covered in the other Shangri-La, called the Yading Natural Reserve. And it's one of the places which claim to be the Shangri-La, the fictional Shangri-La. And it's a beautiful place. It has these three 6,000 meter high mountains surrounding a valley, and it's one of the most beautiful places that I have seen. And it was impossible to go even 40 years back, not just because there were no good roads, but also there were monks who were bandits in these areas. And even though they were Buddhist monks, if anyone from outside went there, they would spend no time in just chopping off their heads. So it was a very dangerous as well as a very tough place to go. But in the last few years, the infrastructure has been built and it's actually very good. And we are able to go there and we are able to see this beauty of nature, which is there, as well as experience the people and their culture in that neighborhood. But of course, in some cases, it might go haywire, and there are obviously environmental repercussions of transport and communications in terms of hills being denuded, dams being built, and so on, you know, pollution which comes from all this travel. So there's definitely a natural destruction element to, or the consequence of all these things that we now take for granted. And the other negative aspect in some sense is that it has led to some degree of homogenization of cultures in some sense that, you know, today if you go to Japan or go to France, you will find so many people speaking Mandarin because their only job is to interact with Chinese tourists who are coming. And a Chinese tourist who goes to Paris, for instance, will not miss much of China because the two groups will ensure that there is always a Chinese speaker attached to them. They're always dining at Chinese restaurants. And there is very limited scope of genuine interaction with the locals. And all this has been made possible because you have this sizable demand of millions of Chinese coming every year to Paris. And there is enough of dollars to create that separate, very Chinese environment for these Chinese tourists. So that's, of course, one of the pitfalls. And but I'm not a naysayer in that sense. I'm not one of those who would say that, you know, tribal people should continue to practice their age-old ways of life and they should remain poor and they should remain isolated from the rest of the world. I'm not one of those people who exoticize poverty or isolation or a lack of scientific progress or achievements in these cultures. I think that even though you may lose some of that because of other modern civilization, if I can call that, coming in, or technological advancement coming in. So even if you lose these things, culture is something which evolves. History is something which evolves continuously. And I, as a person, have evolved so much in the last 40 years. I'm sure you have evolved as well, that none of these things will remain constant, no matter how much hard you try to stop technological advancement reaching these places. So new others will evolve, new owns will evolve, and traveling will always remain interesting because there is always this curiosity among some of us and many of us to know about the other, and sometimes to know more about your own as well, which creates this whole need for traveling, like you mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's brilliantly put and like gels with my last question. So with new media coming in, how and where do you see writing fitting in this visual world? Because YouTube, Instagram, TV, there are like a lot more people doing, actually visiting these places, showing people how the place is in action. I mean, sometimes even live. So there is this big wave of technology which is democratized travel also. I mean, who travels where and everything, right? So how do you see writing as an art form still?
Sure.
Like, where do you see it?
So I would speak more in terms of travel writing because compared to other forms of writing, I believe travel writing has probably been affected the most because of new media. Yeah. And I mentioned things like Instagram, YouTube, TripAdvisor reviews and all blogs, of course, which could be counted as travel writing now. And what has happened is, number one, there's a lot of visual element to travel writing now. So magazines or books in particular, publishers, they will not entertain a writer who is not a good photographer or doesn't have good photos or doesn't have good videos. So many travel writers have been forced to take up photography or videography, or if they are well-known enough, get someone to work together with them in their journeys. What we have also seen is that on the new media, travel writing tend to be of a certain type. They are usually much shorter. Typically, a blog post is about 800 words, whereas a book could be 80,000 words and so on. So they are much shorter pieces, and there's this very strong visual aspect to the way it is presented, photographs, videos, and so on. But it also has led to, like you said, democratization. You see a lot of women writing now. You see young people. You see very niche segments, such as LGBTQ writing. You will see people from the developing countries now taking up a big share. So, you know, in Indonesia, for example, many couples, celebrity couples, or other couples have become celebrities because they have been writing about their travel online. So it has led to this new wave and new popularity and explosion of content about travel. Now, if you ask me, not all of their quality is something I would recommend, because you have so many more people writing, and you don't have the checks and balances which used to come with traditional writing. But the other aspect is also the ethics of travel writing. You know, in traditional travel writing and more serious travel writing, there's a substantial amount of time and effort which goes in from the entire industry to ensure that certain ethics are adhered to, whether it's about representation, fact checks, proper sourcing, not benefiting from, say, poverty or war-related destruction. So all those ethical elements, they tend to get a short end of the stick when it comes to online travel writing, because people, just with so many people, they don't have the resources to do, say, fact checks, for instance. Yeah. So there has been that backdrop as well. Now, going forward, I think what will happen is some of the more common or more or less serious forms of travel writing, let's say like top 10 places to spend your next vacation, or top 10 spas in Bali, these kind of articles will not be written by humans. I think AI and such kind of machine learning pieces should be able to generate such travel writing, very easily. You already see that happening in sports and finance journalism, for instance. I think that will happen in travel in journalism and travel writing as well. So the travel writer will have to really work very hard, unless he or she or whatever gender has a very strong personal story situated around their travel. So this new travel writer over the next 10 years will have to really find those niches and will have to really dig deep into the subjects that he or she is trying to cover, or try to come up with very new angles of looking at the same story. So the kind of work and effort we need to put in will be much harder because of the advent of new media in the next few years.
If machines are going to help us solve certain problems, then it's quite ironic that we have to again put in more hard work.
Yes, yeah. But yeah, I must also say that the demand for the genre will never go down, at least in the next few years, because just as a statistics, I think I'm guessing maybe only 3% of Indians have passport yet. You know, so, and the same thing for China. I think only 10% of Chinese yet have a passport. So imagine 90 to 97% of these big populations are yet to travel. You know, if the income levels go higher, people will travel a lot more. The consumption of travel literature can only increase from where we are today. So I see a bright future, but the effort required from the more serious travel writers is going to be really a lot more than what we are doing now.
You said about ethics. Are there any other things in that? I mean, the question is mainly if you have to give like two tips for upcoming travel writers, especially. What should they find at a fundamental level and then build on top of it?
So I think, of course, there's the ethical part of it, which is what I mentioned earlier, which is not benefiting from someone else's misery, proper acknowledgement of sources, not putting into harm certain sources. Like when I was visiting around these Sino-Tibetan frontier, which is quite a hotspot for Tibetan rebellion against Han rule, I could have put certain people into danger if I quoted their interviews with their names and so on. And then, of course, there's the question of whether you paid for a story, whether you were paid for covering or giving coverage to certain places and so on. So there are all these ethical aspects which kind of form the base. You know, these are something that you have to take care of even before you make a foray into travel writing. Now, once you have taken care of that, and which is what the publisher should also be responsible for, once you have taken care of that, travel writing is essentially about what I mentioned earlier, is how you travel, where you travel, and what you travel for. And then the other part is more the skills of travel writing. And there I would say, first of all, when it comes to how you travel, two things I would say. One I touched upon was the shyness, overcoming shyness, and to be very inquisitive and curious and be vocal about it. And only then you can get the stories out of people. I would also recommend putting some investment into learning languages, especially if you're visiting somewhere for longer than a month and learning the language of the place, because otherwise you'll be just interacting with travel guides who are usually the most nationalistic people. They only paint a rosy picture of that place. And other than that, of course, the research and all you will put in. And when it comes to writing part of it, it comes with practice. It comes with a lot of reading yourself, reading some good travel works, reading any kind of good nonfiction work, and then keep working on it. Work on any good, what are the typical good measures of nonfiction, which is about the structure of the work, what you omit, what you decide to keep, how you put the climax, how you begin. So these aspects of structure, the language, and then having super dialogues, because dialogues are what lead to spice. Dialogues are the spice of any travel writing. So I think that's the writing part of the thing that a wannabe travel writer should go about. But all said and done, I think the most serious blockage that most travel writers or writers feel is that they always make plans, but they don't write. So my only advice to anyone who is interested is forget everything. Just pick up your pen or pick up your computer and start writing, because unless you start, it will never happen.
Yeah, yeah. Quite very, very inspiring and also insightful for me, because travel or writing both are sort of very, very new domains for me. I'm a designer, so it has been really wonderful understanding these nuances which you shared. I think this is a good note to end this. Thanks, Shivaji, for giving your time. And it was really wonderful talking to you.
Thanks, Kedar. Thanks for having me on AudioGear. It was lovely talking to you.
Yeah. So actually, I forgot before we conclude, how people do connect with you? Where do they buy the other Shangri-La book and other books?
Yeah, they are all available on Amazon and Flipkart and any good bookshop like Higginbotham's and all. They should be available. Barisan's, Higginbotham's. I think they're all available in India and internationally, online as well as in bookshops.
Cool. All the best and thanks a lot again for being on the show, and happy journey for your next travel
after, yes, as and when that happens.
after the COVID.
Yes. Likewise, thanks for your time and consideration, and keep in touch.
Yes, thank you. That's it.
And that's it from today's Gyan session. Catch us on iTunes, Saavn, Stitcher, or any podcasting app you use. Do rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Stay tuned for more Gyan on audiogyan.com. Till then, bye.